All right, if you would, make your way to John chapter 15. And as you find John 15, we find ourselves on the night of the crucifixion. I mean, this is just sheer hours away from Jesus being, betrayed, going through that mock trial and being nailed to a cross the very next day. As this night began, we began way back in chapter 13. As Jesus there began to wash the disciples' feet, showing them what it was to serve one another. Then we see right after that, Jesus, He identified Judas as a betrayer. Not as a way of singling him out so he could be, jumped on, just as a way of letting the apostles know that once this betrayal happened, you will know that I am He. You will know that this didn't sneak up on me. This didn't catch me by surprise. To which Peter then decides to say, Lord, that they may betray you, but I never will betray you. To which Jesus corrects Peter, rebukes Peter. Peter, look, you will deny me in just a few short hours. Just a few short hours, you will deny me three times before the cock crows. And so he's sitting here and he's telling them all these things and he's letting them know that he's going away. And when he goes away, they cannot follow him. And this is just, it's troubling their hearts that they can't follow their master. So he tells them all through chapter 14 that he's sending a helper, another one, just like me, who will never leave you. And as he's gone, he tells them as in chapter 15 to abide in him, to remain in him as the vine. They are just simply branches that are to bear fruit. He is the vine. He is what sustains them. He is what holds everything together. And so as we get here, we are in chapter 15. Today we would deal with verses 12 through 17. Let's read. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends. For all that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide. So that whatever you ask the Father in my name, He will give it to you. These things I command you, so that you will love one another. You see right off the bat here, we get this real unique relationship. We've read about the shepherd and the sheep. Now we're reading about not just nearly master and slave, we're reading about master and friends. He's brought them in and near and dear to himself. So what we're reading today, if I want a title, to be Friends of the King. This is the King, and this group is, he's called here, friends. Friends of the King. I know it's not but a few verses, and so when you get a six verse passage that you're dealing with, you don't have it memorized verbatim, but all the components are kind of just stuck in your head, and you're just thinking about it for a week or so, and it's strange how much you can wrestle with six verses, but I've enjoyed it, and I pray that we get something out of it today. So we begin in verse 12. He says, this is my commandment. Now the way Jesus says this really just kind of presupposes that the question was floating around, what is your commandment? When he says, this is my commandment. And naturally they would have been asking this question, for just a few verses earlier we read in verse 10, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I've kept my Father's commandments and I abide in His love. These things He has spoken to you, that my joy may be complete in you and your joy may be full. Well, this is my commandment. This is my commandment. So now the commandments plural that we read about up in verse 10 have really been compressed down to one. This is singular. This is my commandment. I don't think this is really new. If we were just a few short hours earlier, In John 13:34, we read this. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. Just as I've loved you, You also are to love one another. And by this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. That's what Jesus is saying here. This is my commandment, that you love one another. The same thing. And a few days earlier, according to Matthew's account, this is where the Pharisees come up to Jesus and they're trying to stump him. Matthew 22, verse 34 says this. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." I think really Jesus is really just kind of summing all this up. He had said it a few days earlier. He had kind of, you know, driven it home for them right there earlier, just a few hours earlier. And here he's saying again, "This is my commandment." Now, before we move on, it is interesting to me that Jesus giving commandments can be blasphemous because only God gives commandments. In Scripture, we only see God giving commandments. And here Jesus is speaking just as authoritatively as the Father. Maybe this is just another one of those little subtle digs we have that Jesus is God. So when Jesus makes these commandments, it's just like the Father spoke from Mount Sinai. So, "This is my commandment, that you love one another." This Jesus is stressing the importance of love and unity to this group. It's the love and unity that's going to set them apart from the world. And this is going to fight against their fleshly instincts. Again, in Luke, you take Luke's account, just a few hours ago, right after the supper, they began to argue over who would be the greatest. They had the Lord's Supper. He had talked about He was going to be betrayed. And they want to know who's going to be the greatest. You see, this just fights against our natural self. You know, He had just washed their feet. He just spoke of His betrayal. But putting others first is just unnatural. Maybe another reason Jesus is saying this, and we're going to get this next week in verses 18 and 19, He lets them know there that if the world hates you, know that it's hated me before it hates you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. They're fixing to go into the world and they're going to be hated. This is going behind enemy lines or going into enemy territory. So they are to love one another, which will completely set them apart from the world. There is going to be a cost in following Jesus. You may be hated by the world, but you can embrace brotherly love. A love that's not self-seeking. Rather, it's seeking the well-being of others. But most importantly, you're loved by God. Loved by God. See, this is what He says. This is my commandment. That you should love one another as I have loved you. Look, this is twofold now. It comforts His disciples, knowing that they're loved by God. That's got to be comforting. The downside of that, if there is a downside of that, it sets the standard pretty high. Right? How should they love one another? As Jesus had loved them. And then in verse 13, it really just supports verse 12. How does He love them? "Greater love has no one than this, that someone laid down his life for his friends." That's descriptive. Descriptive of this great love that He had for them. Was laying down His life for them. Nobody has a greater love than that. Then what? Then laying down His life for His friends. That's the way He demonstrates His love for them. He demonstrates His love for them by laying down His life for His friends. This isn't a completely new concept either, by the way. just a few months earlier, when Jesus is teaching, He's teaching about the shepherd, the good shepherd, and the sheep. And He says, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down His life for His sheep. So you see, this isn't new. Jesus here will lay down His life for His friends. They were His friends. His friends. Greek word, philos. It's akin to the word phileo, which is where we get the word love. So this concept of a friend, someone that is loved, it probably gets misconstrued in our culture. It does. I mean, everybody has Facebook friends, right? You know, actually Facebook had to cap it at 5,000 friends. They won't let you have more than 5,000 friends because everybody has 5,000 friends. So you see how we can easily misapply that label. We can misapply the label of friend. Or maybe you've heard on a Saturday, maybe a football broadcaster would say, we're just 85,000 friends gather. Right? This is where 85,000 friends gather. And you may know 25 people in there. But there's 85,000 friends, the way they throw the word out there. Or here's a funny one to me. The old ancient proverb, and I know you've heard it, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. How is that your friend? But you see, we just throw that label of friend on nearly anything. That's quite different than the friendship Jesus describes here. And to use a few scriptural definitions of this, we can look at Luke 23, verse 12. It says there that Herod and Pilate became friends with each other on that day. For before this, they had been enemies of each other. So if they're goaded, you know, they take Jesus and they send him to Herod to be condemned and put to death. And Herod, you know, will send him to Pilate to be condemned and put to death. They just send them back and forth. Before that, they hated one another. But on that day, they had a common goal, and it was to put Jesus to death, and they became friends. Friends. Or you could go on in this book, John 19. As Pilate is looking to release Jesus, it says 19 verse 12, if you release this man Jesus, you're not Caesar's friend. So you see how we can just attach that label of friend to so many petty things and people we don't even know and never met. But that's not what Jesus describes here. The friendship Jesus describes is more than just a shared common interest like we read between Herod and Pilate. Jesus is willing to sacrifice for His friends. And when Jesus is in anguish, as we read in John 14, He concerns Himself with their troubled hearts. Their hearts are troubled, and He's just got through talking about His betrayal, and He's more concerned with them. He tells them the truth at all times. Sometimes that truth is comforting, as it was in John 14. He says, look, I go, and if I go to prepare a place for you, and if I come again, I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. That is truth that is comforting. Sometimes the truth is just hard to hear. As He told Peter, you will deny me three times before the rooster crows. But He always told him the truth. That's what a friend does. And so just thinking about the example of Jesus, the example He set of friendship, speaking the truth in love, serving others, tending to their needs, it's no wonder that Scripture paints Jesus out to be the Good Shepherd. Laying down His life for His sheep, laying down His life for His friends, Jesus will die, as we see here, for those whom He calls His friends. Now, like I told you, this is six verses, and you kind of just mulling around in your head all day, and then something just hits you, and you're like, oh no, how am I gonna explain that? So I'm reading this. No greater love has no one than this, than someone would lay down his life for his friends. And then I remembered a verse, and you will be familiar with this. As Judas is leading that that cohort of Roman soldiers up to Jesus. He's going to go to Jesus in the garden. He's going to identify Jesus, betraying Jesus with a kiss. Jesus says, "Friend, do what you've come to do." Somebody, oh man. How? Jesus died for His friends. Jesus calls Judas friend. Did Jesus just refer to Judas as a friend? Yes and no. Alright, the friend we're reading about here in John 15 was the word philos. You know where we got the word love. You know, phileo, philos. In Matthew, the word is heteros. Completely different word. Alright, so get this. This is interesting. Matthew is the only one that uses that word. He uses it three times. Heteros. Alright? We just read about the one right there in Matthew 26 where Judas betrays Jesus with a kiss and Jesus says, "Friend, do what you came to do." I'm going to give you the definition of that Greek word heteros and then we'll look at the other two ways it's used. By definition, it means someone posing to be a friend but in reality only has his own interest in mind. You see Judas all in that, don't you? And, here's another definition, an imposter acting for self-gain. Well, that fits Judas. So, alright, that's the way the word is used in Matthew 26. Here's another way it's used, again in Matthew 22. It's the parable of the wedding feast. When that man kind of snuck into the wedding feast, it says in Matthew 22:11, "But when the king came in to look at the guests, he saw a man there who had no wedding garment. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding garment?' And he was speechless. The king said to the attendants, 'Bind him hand and foot, cast him out into utter darkness, outer darkness.'" So again, you see someone there posing as a friend, acting for self-gain. Alright? We also have another example of this word, heteros, in Matthew 20. Verse 8, this is the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. You know, the ones who come and they begin work early in the morning for a denarius. Then some pop up at 9 o'clock and they're working for a denarius. Some start at 12, some start at 3. You get the point. Matthew 20, verse 8, it says, "When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first.' And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, 'These last only worked 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us and have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat.' But he replied to one of them, saying, 'Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree to work with me for a denarius?'" Again, that is someone imposing, you know, being an imposter, posing himself as a friend for self-gain. So all that was really just to show you that Judas is not a friend, philos, that we read about in John 15. That does not fit Judas by any stretch of the imagination. Even when Jesus refers to him as friend, it's not what we're reading here. It is almost a mockery. It is an imposter. So Judas is not the friend of our Savior. But in verse 14, "You are my friends." Judas is not, but "you are my friends if you do what I command you." If we do what He commands, then will we be called friends? That doesn't really square with Scripture as a whole. Jesus' love for us isn't reciprocal. It's not tit for tat. You know, He doesn't work that way. And just think of where that error can take you. If you do what I command you, you will be my friend. And if you are my friend, I will lay down my life for you. So really, in going down that road, our actions cause Jesus to lay down His life for us. In that sense, we play some part in our salvation. That doesn't square. That doesn't work. That's not what's being said. So don't confuse cause and effect here. Just don't do that. Jesus doesn't lay down His life for us because we love one another. Rather, we love one another because He's loved us to the max. That's what's being said. We love one another because He's loved us to the max, or it says in John 13, He's loved us to the end, laying down His life for His sheep, laying down His life for His friends. But some take this and try to build this works-based salvation. And I guess I get why, but it doesn't work. Grammatically, it doesn't work, and it just doesn't work. There's not an if-then. You don't see that in here. You don't say, if you do what I command, then you will be my friend. You know, we may do that as kids, you know, just if you do this, then we can play together. That's not what Jesus does. We were already His friends, or they were already His friends. He said that in verse 12. He has loved them. Verse 12, love one another as I have loved you. He'd already loved them. Again, we read earlier, He loved them to the end. He loved those whom the Father had given Him. He loved them to the end. And in verse 15, He's already calling them friends. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I called you friends. He's calling them friends. And I thought they were only friends if they did what He's commanded, but He's already calling them friends. He's already loved them. You have to see Jesus is the one who acts here. He's the one who initiates all this. Look, the point is, their love for one another was proof that they were His. That was proof. It was affirmation of their faith. A few hours earlier, we read, by this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So love for the brethren is the mark of a Christian. And the same John who penned this gospel actually wrote in 1 John 4, verse 20, if anyone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother, he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from Him, from Jesus, whoever loves God must also love his brother. We see the roots of that right here. So he goes on in verse 15. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I've made known to you. No longer do I call you servants. No longer do I call you slaves. Doulos. That's that word, slaves. So when did we really... The way he says this, I will no longer call you slaves. When did we read about this master-slave relationship language? Well, again, you know, it's all here. Just a few hours earlier, you know, when they were in the upper room, Jesus had got down on his knees and washed their feet. He tells them there, you call me teacher and master, Lord. You call me teacher and master, and you are right, for so I am. If then, as your Lord and teacher, I've washed your feet, you ought to also wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do just as I've done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you that a slave is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than him who sent him. So we've picked up on this relationship throughout the Gospel of John. This is not the first time we run into the slave-master relationship. And he says here, I am no longer calling you slaves. So here's how their relationship is going to differ from the typical master-slave relationship. I will no longer call you slaves, For the slave does not know what his master is doing. So here's the difference. That's a typical master-slave relationship. But I'm not going to call you that, for typically slaves don't know what their master is doing, but I've called you friends. For all that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. I have called you friends. For all that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. And then he just moves, let's ease on into verse 16 and we'll back up a little bit. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide. So that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. In that day, it was typical for a learner, people, to seek out a teacher and just attach themselves to that teacher. We're actually reading about that in 1 Corinthians, right? They were attaching themselves to Paul. I'm of Paul. They were attaching themselves to Apollos, to Peter. But Jesus is saying, you didn't choose me. I chose you. And this word here, chose, it's actually the verb form of where we get the Greek word elect. It's the same word there. Chosen. He has chosen you. You were previously slaves. Slaves to sin, according to Romans 6, verse 20. You're slaves by your nature. You're slaves by your birthright. You were slaves. You were born into slavery. But Christ has redeemed them. Christ has redeemed them. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18 says, knowing that you were ransomed, you were redeemed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. So they were ransomed, they were redeemed by the blood of Christ. Okay, we have to get this. We are slaves who were bought and brought into a relationship with their master. Friends of the King. Still slaves, simply shown an extraordinary love from the Lord. Extraordinary love from the Master. Well, doesn't this mean, you could easily see, doesn't this mean that we're no longer slaves? Because he says, I have no longer calling you slaves. What it said in verse 15. I no longer call you slaves. Well, if that's the case, then why does every single New Testament writer identify themselves as a slave? Paul, a slave of Jesus Christ. Jude, a slave of Jesus Christ. James, John, Peter. Why? It's because that foundational relationship is never flipped. It's never flipped. I know the prosperity gospel, it seems like they just turn it on its head to where Jesus is here serving us. You know, we name it, we claim it, we speak it, and He's duty-bound to do it for us. He serves us. You see how that the whole thing's got turned on its head? But it never has in the eyes of the apostles. He is always master. They're always blood-bought slaves. We may be friends, but we're still under His authority. Maybe it harkens back to Exodus 21. We could read there about slaves who were free, but yet they loved their master and chose rather to remain in the house of their master. Willing slaves. Not necessarily servants, as we read here. Slaves. So we're slaves, but we've been brought into this relationship, into the inner council to where God is sharing everything He's heard from the Father, which is amazing, by the way. But then He goes on, you did not choose me, right? I chose you. I drew you. You know, if you were a slave, you didn't pick who bought you in that sense. He selected them and bought them and brought them in. And then He says He chose them and appointed them that they should go and bear fruit. and that your fruit should abide, so whatever you ask in the whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you." So you see, they were chosen for a purpose. Are we seeing this? They were chosen for a purpose. "I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit." Chosen for a purpose. Which again just completely destroys hard shell theology, because if you read up earlier, they were chosen here to bear fruit, but according to John 15 verse 4, it says, "Abide in me and I in you, as a branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me." So they were chosen to bear fruit, and they could not bear fruit outside of Jesus. So how can you abide or remain in Jesus if you've never heard of Him? And if you're not in Him, you can't bear fruit. If you can't bear fruit, He didn't choose you. You're not none of His. You're one of the branches that are chopped off and thrown into the fire. You just can't bear fruit unless you're abiding in the vine. He chose you. The Spirit drew you through the gospel. He's taken you. He's grafted you in order that you would bear fruit. We were ordained unto good works, as Ephesians would say. And then it says this. It says, He has appointed to them, He appointed them that they should go and bear fruit. You should go and bear fruit. In earlier, just quick reading in chapter 15, it says that they should abide, that they should remain, some translations read. So, remain and go. And you may, well, that's a little contradicting. But it's not. You should go. You know, I think this is early indications of the Great Commission. This is just little ripples of the Great Commission here. But even when they go, they are to abide in Him. They are to be rooted in Him. They are to be knit to Him by the Spirit they have received from Him. Because they can do nothing on their own. They can only produce fruit if they are abiding in Him, and they're doing that even when they go. He's loved them. He's chosen them. He bought them. He brought them in as friends. He taught them all He had heard from the Father and sends them out to bear fruit. And as they go, He gives them the Spirit that will never leave them. We read that in John 14, verse 16. And when they go out, we're going to get this next week, when they go out, it's in enemy territory. They will be hated. And then we get to verse 17. Verse 17 says, "These things I command you so that you will love one another." This section opens and closes with this phrase, loving one another. So as you see, there's I hope y'all were able to just kind of draw from this little six verse passage, and there's probably some things like, I wish you would have addressed this. It may just be because I didn't see it, or probably because I don't have the mindset to put it all together. But nonetheless, what's being taught here is that they were to love one another, which would set them apart from the world. This is how others would know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. This would be a distinguishing mark of being a follower of Jesus, was loving one another. And He had set the example by the way I loved you, by laying down my life for my friends, as He says here. I lay down my life for my friends. And remember, just kind of plug it away, when He refers to Judas as a friend, that's not this friend. This is phileo, or philos. Judas is not that. Judas was the heteros, or whatever it was. It was the imposter. So He's talking about laying down His life for His friends, those whom He loves. And they have a relationship that's a little bit greater than a master-slave. It's that's still at the base of it, but it's actually He brought them in as friends and shared with them everything that the Father has taught them. He had chosen them. He had reached them and brought them in and appointed them to good works that they should go and do. And as they go on their way bearing fruit, they must remain in Him. So there's a lot to this little passage. I pray that y'all were able to follow along with me. If you were, then maybe we've got something out of it. If you would please stand.